You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Their story made headlines around the world nearly 5 years ago. Three Americans, journalist and photographer Shane Bauer, writer and educator Sarah Shurd, and environmental advocate Joshua Fatal, were hiking in the northern Iraqi province of Kurdistan when they may have mistakenly crossed the border into Iran. They were captured by the Iranian Border Patrol, accused of espionage, and then blindfolded and shuttled from prison to prison in the middle of the night until they ended up in Tehran's infamous Evin prison. Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Shurd recount their dark days as political prisoners and reflect on the strengths of will and friendship that helped carry them to freedom in a book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. It brought the three of them to our show last March, and we are re-airing that interview now. I began by asking them, how did the three of you know each other, and how did you find yourselves hiking in Turkey and Kurdistan in the summer of 2009?
Well, Shane and I had been dating for years, and in 2008 we moved to the Middle East. We traveled through Yemen, Lebanon, and settled in Damascus, Syria, where I was teaching Iraqi refugees and doing some journalism. And Shane had been a journalist for years in the region.
Wasn't there a fourth member of the party? Was he just lucky to have stayed in your hotel with a cold?
Kind of, yeah. It was a friend, Sean McFessel. Both Josh and Sean were old friends of mine, and they came to visit Sarah and I in Damascus.
So, Josh, when Shane and Sarah said, hey, let's go hiking in Kurdistan, you thought that was a good idea?
Yeah, I said I'm visiting the Middle East, and, you know, it's if you say that's safe and the New York Times says it's a place to go, then let's go.
Where were you hiding to? Hiking to?
We were hiking by a really popular tourist destination called Ahmed Awa, which is a beautiful waterfall. Any water in the Middle East is a big attraction. And the mountains in Iraqi Kurdistan are very green and just beautiful.
Well, when news of your capture by the Iranian military broke that summer, many people in this country wondered aloud what you could possibly have been thinking hiking in northern Iraq anywhere near the Iranian border. But you felt you had extensive knowledge of the Middle East, so this was not a problem?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's, you know, when Americans think, you know, someone's hiking in Iraq, they think Baghdad. And Kurdistan is, it's almost its own country, you know. No American has ever been injured or killed there. There's about 2 million tourists actually go there every year.
Were you aware of how close you were to the Iranian border?
We weren't. You know, that's something that we've all spent a lot of time regretting.
And there still is some doubt as to whether you actually crossed the border.
Yeah, that's correct. We later found out that the trail that we were hiking on at the top of that ridge is the border. And the
and you never made it to the top?
Well, we made it to the top, but that's where the borders called us off the trail, or the border guards. We thought they were Peshmerga Kurdish soldiers, but it turned out they were Iranian soldiers.
And the border guard actually later contacted Sarah on Facebook and apologized.
I was convinced that it was him because he knew every detail of our conversation, and he said he regretted, you know, having been a part of that, and he confirmed that they called us into Iran.
We were hiking in an area that we're talking about a couple hundred feet between where we were and the ridge of that mountain and the guy waving us over. And so it all gets pretty ambiguous where exactly the line was and how we crossed and when we crossed.
Well, Shane, you write that at one point you got the feeling Sarah sensed danger and wanted to turn back, but you and Josh decided to continue.
Yeah, there was a point on that hike where we stopped and had lunch and we were kind of low on water. We had to get back to meet our friend Sean, and you know, Sarah said, let's turn back, and I was kind of like, well, the ridge is right up there, and, you know, let's just pop up there, get the view.
Was the waterfall worth it?
Definitely not.
What was the process of writing this book? It reads like diary entries, but obviously you weren't keeping those entries while you were in captivity.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, to some extent, actually, we did. There was a process where we could steal pens, and when our mothers visited, we got a few pens that I snuck in my pants, and could write really small on the letters that our family gave us, and then fold those letters up and sneak them out in the bindings of hardback books. So we're able to get very, not all those journals were able to get out, but we did get some notes from inside.
Although yes. I also have the sense that this was such a powerful experience for you that you remember a lot of details.
You do. And it was incredible for us because we all, though we can relate to each other's experience better than anyone else in the world, we had very different experiences. So the book offers three perspectives. And I think the other value of three authors is that we were able to really challenge each other on the facts and, you know, double and triple check everything.
Well, what was the general atmosphere at the outpost on the Iranian border? Did you immediately sense that you might be in serious trouble?
No, it was a while before I let myself believe that it could be serious. For Americans in the Middle East, being detained and questioned by soldiers is relatively common. It usually is over in a few hours. And they continue to tell us that they were driving us back to Iraq.
I mean, even on the way down from the mountain, there was a man at the police station who was sort of almost yelling at us about this situation where the Americans had taken these Iranian diplomats captive in Iraq, and how problematic it was that the U.S. is detaining these Iranians. And even at that point, and it had been over 2 years, he was saying, 2 years, can you believe it? Detention. And even at that point, I just had this feeling of like, well, we wouldn't get caught up in such a political mess like that. We don't have anything to do with that.
So do you think that's the reason for this? You were just being used as kind of punishment for...
I wouldn't pin it down to such as to that. I mean,
would the soldiers have even been thinking along those lines? That's the kind of thing that somebody in Tehran might...
In Western Iran. That was a guy, you know, right there, you know, soon thereafter that had, I think, the idea that once they saw our American passports, the idea that we were currency and potential retaliation for American misdeeds in the Middle East became an obvious chip for us.
Yeah, this became clear pretty quickly. After we were interrogated for a couple of months, and our interrogators told us at the end of that time that they knew that we weren't spies and that our case had become political, and that their politicians, in their government, have to negotiate with politicians in our government, we would have to wait.
You were told that you were going to be taken back to the Iraqi border. Why do you think they said that when you were actually being taken to Tehran?
I think I think it's how you're trained. If you work for the secret police in a country, to lie to the people you have captive, wanted to keep us calm. Yeah, they wanted us to not try to escape.
It's a strategic cultivation of false hope that pretty much prevailed throughout the whole 26 months.
Mm-hmm. When did you first hear that you were being charged with espionage?
For me, it was at the end of the 2 months of interrogation.
Oh, that long.
Oh, yeah. Pretty much constant interrogation.
And what kind of espionage were they accusing you of?
Well, my interrogator said from the beginning, I know you're not a spy, but the questioning was still along those lines. Most of the time, it was a total farce. They asked me to recite William Blake to prove that I was an English major and an English teacher. They asked me to draw a picture of the inside of the lobby of the Pentagon, and when I said I'd never been there, they said, but all teachers go to the Pentagon. So it was hard to take it seriously, but of course we knew at some level that our lives could be on the line. We knew we were being charged. But after 2 months, my interrogator said, I'm sorry, I told you would go to trial and that you would be released after trial, but your case has become political and I don't know if you'll go to trial, and I don't know if you did, if the result would be good.
What would have happened if you had gone to the Pentagon and you had told them that just on a visit?
Would have been the same thing, honestly. It became clear in those interrogations that who we were didn't matter. You know, I tried convincing my interrogators, look, I'd investigated U.S. military corruption in Iraq, and, you know, I think critically about my government, but that none of that mattered. You know, they can always wrap that back into the spy narrative, say, well, that's just a good CIA cover.
Well, after they had you, Sarah, write your biography, they tore it up and threw it at your feet.
Yeah, exactly.
That was in a way of saying it really doesn't matter. Mm.
Well, it was also a way of saying, unless you write what we want you to write, we're not going to accept it.
You know, even 2 years after our detention, when we finally went to trial, the idea that it had finally sunk in to Shane and I that, you know, it really doesn't matter who we are to them and what we stand for. And I remember going before we went to trial, she and I were taking bets on what kind of evidence they were going to fabricate about our to put us as guilty.
My guests are Josh Vital, Shane Bauer, Sarah Shord. They have collaborated on a book about their experiences of being imprisoned in Iran called A Sliver of Light. This whole thing happened not long after a popular democratic uprising, the Green Movement, that was quashed in Iran. Do you think that your arrest was part of an assertion of control by President Ahmadinejad and the Revolutionary Guard, a way of saying the threat from America persists and we shouldn't liberalize?
Sure.
I think there were like many levels. You know, there was Iran holding us, showed their power vis-a-vis the United States, that they could hold us and refuse, you know, to give us over. And it also had a domestic purpose to show, we have American spies in our midst. We have to be careful because this opposition is backed by the United States.
Well, were you able to speak to any of the other prisoners and find out what they thought about you?
That's the thing is, I mean, if that tactic worked, xenophobia is one way that the Iranian government tries to make their own people believe that even their internal opposition is caused by people from the West and from the outside. But inside prison, many times we heard from people that they knew about our politics, and they never believed the lies that their government was telling about us.
We were allowed to visit the Swiss ambassador who represents the U.S. interests in Iran, and we met her after 2 months in detention. And I remember when she wasn't allowed to say much to us because we were surrounded by the Iranian interrogators and whatnot, but she said, you know, this is really not a good time to be here, and she was alluding to the protests.
Well, Shane, you wrote, things are moving forward, we're going to clear this up, they will ask me questions and understand they made a huge mistake. Mm. They don't want an international scandal, they're figuring out how to ease out gracefully. Mm. In retrospect, that was pretty naive thinking.
Yeah, and you know, there was, I was convinced, trying to convince myself of that, even at that time that I was writing about. It wasn't the dominant feeling, but when I would have kind of an interrogation where the interrogators were being amicable with me, sometimes it'd be harsh, sometimes they'd act like they were my friend, I would think, okay, you know, this is moving along, but it's just another tactic.
Josh, during your first interrogation, you told the Iranian officer that you're Christian, although you're Jewish. Was that a spur-of-the-moment decision, or had you thought, what happens if they ask me my religion? What will I say?
Well, I remember in the car before we were put in interrogation, when Shane, Sarah, and I were sitting there, we were kind of thinking through all the things that we, you know, we just didn't want them to be suspicious of us for any reason. And that was the thing for me that I thought, well, I don't know if they'd be if that would make them suspicious or not, but I better hedge my bets.
But then they discovered you were Jewish and that your father had Israeli citizenship.
Yeah. My father was born in Iraq but moved to Israel as a young child and before moving to America, and that's where I was born. But that became just it was something that they could potentially and tried to weave into a story of espionage.
At one point in the book you write, I look forward to interrogations, but they come only once a week. What about the interrogations what was it about them that you could possibly enjoy?
Well, I mean, sitting in a room blindfolded with soundproof walls and a couple of intimidating guards, I could see why you would think that perhaps it wouldn't be that enjoyable. But all day in the cell alone, I guess I'm just thinking of so much time thinking about interrogation, how to answer the questions.
It gave you a chance to interact with other people.
It gave me a chance to interact. It made hours go by, broke up the day. And one of the things was it gave me a chance to kind of speak my mind, even if I wasn't being listened to. At least I got to like argue with someone.
And you weren't afraid of being tortured?
I was worried about it for sure.
I assume all of you were worried about that.
Well, yes, we were. I mean, even after a few months in solitary confinement, at one point a lizard found its way into my cell, and it greatly decreased my anxiety. I felt better than I had for weeks.
Were you talking
to it? The company of another. No, I didn't talk to it. I just the company of another living thing makes a difference. In solitary confinement, you lose contact with the outside world.
I want to come back to solitary confinement and some of the other issues about your confinement after we take a little break. My guests are Sarah Shurd, Joshua Fatale, and Shane Bauer. They have written a joint memoir of their experiences as prisoners in Iran. The book is called A Sliver of Light. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Stay with us. We're back with my interview with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Shurd, which originally aired in March. They've written a book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. I asked Shane, a lot has been made of the fact that when you complained about your conditions, your captors reminded you of the conditions at Guantanamo Bay and at the CIA's black sites around the world. What effect did those comparisons have on your psyche?
Well, the first time it came up was when I was in solitary confinement, and I would complain to a guard about being in solitary confinement for 4 months, and he said to me, well, what about Guantanamo? You know, why are people there in solitary? And then as time went on, we hadn't gone to trial for 2 years, and we'd say, why haven't we gone to trial? If you think we're guilty, take us to trial. And they said, what about Guantanamo? You know, and it was hard to argue with that. You know, I would say, well, don't you want to be better than that? I mean, they, you know, for them, people, they've seen people for 10 years or more going without trial in Guantanamo Bay. And there were other times where, you know, we kind of realized how valuable we were to the Iranian government, and that kind of gave us some power. And sometimes Josh and I would hear other prisoners being beaten. And there's one instance in particular where this man had been very, very broken down. Guards would open the door of his cell and he would just scream. He was terrified. And one time a bunch of guards came to his cell and we didn't know what was going on. We heard chains, we heard water running, and this man was screaming at the top of his lungs. And we got up and we pounded on the door, which we would do from time to time when we'd hear people getting beaten. And a guard came running, he was angry, standing at the door, and Josh and I said, what is this, Guantanamo? And he's looked at us like, what? Like, that was such an insult, you know? And then they stopped beating that prisoner, you know? This, you know, in their minds, this is the worst possible thing that exists in the world.
But I'd imagine you also were afraid that they would cite some of the torture that has come out about treatment of prisoners over the years,
right,
and use that as an excuse to torture you?
Well, we were afraid of that in the beginning, afraid of being tortured, afraid of being raped. We know those things happen in Iranian prisons. And we soon realized that we were lucky, that we had a certain protection because we were American and because they were holding us as valuable prisoners that they would eventually cash in.
Well, this place is often called the infamous Evin prison. Why infamous? Is it worse than other Iranian prisons?
It's where political prisoners are held, and they were before the Shah and during the time of the Shah and after the Iranian Islamic Revolution. So I was able to eventually communicate with other female political prisoners. These are human rights lawyers, protesters, and one woman, Zahra Bahrami, told me that she was beaten severely at the bottom of her feet, that she couldn't stand.
Shane, at one point your interrogator showed you a photo taken from Sarah's camera of Sarah and you in Tel Aviv, and you suddenly felt guilty as though you'd been hiding a crime.
Yeah, these were photos. Sarah and I had visited Israel, actually, to visit a friend of ours, Tristan Anderson, who had recently been shot with a tear gas canister by the Israeli military and was severely injured. He was in the hospital. And when I saw this picture, Sarah erased it from her camera immediately when we were arrested. And I had this feeling like, oh, man, we tried to hide this. I was already deep enough into it that felt like a crime just being there. And I tried to hide a crime, and it was getting hard to kind of pick apart.
Well, it could be used against you,
right,
couldn't it?
Right.
Sarah, during the first month of your captivity, weren't you and Shane held in the same area of the prison?
Yeah.
Were you able to communicate?
We were in adjacent cells, and we soon discovered that we could talk through a vent. We both had bathrooms in the cell in the early days, and there was a vent in the bathroom, and if I whispered into it, Shane could hear me. So at first we were scared to do it. We thought we'd be caught, but then we ended up spending most of our time talking.
But then when you went to Evan Prison, that was no longer the case?
Well, this was in the same compound. It was a different section of Evin Prison. When they transferred us, I was in complete solitary confinement for the rest of my time there.
And you said that you were afraid of being tortured and raped, but a voice in the interrogation room told you otherwise. Who was that person?
I had two interrogators. They played the good guy, good cop, bad cop kind of scenario, and it was quite effective. I was blindfolded. I was expecting physical torture or rape, and one of them was very intimidating to me. He got very close to me and tried to scare me, and the other one came in with his soft, honey, sweet voice, reassuring me and telling me that nothing of that sort would ever happen to me.
Well, you've seen enough cop shows to know what that technique is all about.
After thinking about it, I did. I put two and two together. But in that, you know, in that situation, I think very few people could hold it together and not be affected.
Josh, over the course of your imprisonment, you would use hunger strikes as a form of protest. How effective were they?
Well, Shane Center and I decided immediately that if they separate us, that would be the worst thing in the world, and we should immediately go on hunger strike. And we did. And it didn't really work. I mean, we ended up getting a short dinner together, and that was all. It took another year and a half until we decided to do that again. And really, that through that time, we had really come to terms with how valuable we were, and had seen an international campaign take off on our behalf. And when we did that, we kind of gained a sort of sense that we could affect them, because we decided that every 30 days, if we don't get letters, we'll go back on hunger strike. And we continued that for 6 or 8 months.
So was it through the letters that you became aware that your situation was being covered by international news organizations and protested by Ban Ki-moon of the UN?
Yeah, it was through letters that we got that sense, because that was really our main source of news from the outside world. We only had very little phone calls or meetings or anything.
Some of these were letters from Sarah. You know, after she got out, there was this surreal experience of having her in there in the prison with us, and then actually just kind of getting letters from her.
Yeah,
but you were out after 14 months. Did they tell you why they were letting you out while keeping the other two in prison?
Different authorities in Iran said different things. Some cited my so-called health problems, but they actually knew that I had a clean bill of health. They used it as a way to save face and not look weak by releasing me. They needed to ease the international pressure. It had reached a tipping point, and they needed to let go some of this of the pressure. So
release the woman.
Yeah. So they released me. They also, the judge told me that I was in solitary confinement, and that was a harsher punishment. So I was being released first. When I was inside, we had some intimations of the campaign, and that really kept us alive. I mean, as a prisoner, knowing you're not forgotten psychologically is the most important thing. But when I got out, it was absolutely shocking to me just how big it was. In the first 24 hours, I was on Oprah, and then I met with President Ahmadinejad and President Obama. I don't think anyone else in history has had that opportunity. And then I found advocates in the most unlikely places. Actor Sean Penn advocated to the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, who called Ahmadinejad, and they had a brotherly connection. And Ahmadinejad promised Jane and Josh's release.
Is that what he told you?
That's what he told President
Chavez.
But
what did he tell you?
President Ahmadinejad. He told me the hardest thing sitting across from him was getting him to look me in the eye. He was just going on and on about all these things. Oh, you're good kids. I appreciate your activism. Acting very humble, like he was known to do. And I finally got him to lock eyes with me when he said, you know, I can't wait till you're married. I hope you have 18 children. And I said, how am I supposed to get married with my husband when you're holding my husband captive?
My guests are Sarah Shurd, Shane Bauer, and Joshua Fatale. The book that they have collaborated on is called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And Shane, what Sarah is referring to is that when you were together in prison, you were able to propose marriage?
I did, yeah. I kind of made the decision in solitary confinement. I thought a lot about my life, reflected on every corner and every year of my life, and knew that I wanted to be with Sarah forever. I was also reading these kind of Victorian novels at the time, which helped encourage me to kind of ask the question. But I was, you know, I wanted to wait. I imagined kind of being free and going off into the mountains somewhere beautiful with a bottle of wine and cheese. But then we start getting intimations that Sarah might be released before us. And I decided that I didn't know when I would see her again, you know, and I wanted her I knew that being on the outside was going to be really hard for her without us and feeling like she left us behind. I wanted her to know.
And you made an engagement ring out of thread?
Yeah. It was one of many examples of, how we made the most of the little we had. I kind of took some thread from towel and underwear and wove a ring.
Sarah, you mentioned being in solitary confinement, and right now there is a movement in this country to eliminate most solitary confinement because of what it does to the mental state of the prisoner. Did you ever lose your grip on reality?
Many times. The miracle is that I always found my way back. People need to realize that solitary confinement doesn't just happen in Iran. That the UN says that anything over 15 days can cause permanent psychological damage and constitute torture. And
so how long were you kept in solitary confinement?
For 410 days. And in this country, we hold people for years and even decades. And these are not just people that have committed violent infractions or crimes within prison. These are people often that are guilty of petty infractions or arbitrarily placed in solitary for mental illness. Solitary confinement is like a slow death. It's the slow motion torture of being buried alive.
So how long did it take you to recover after you were released?
Well, I didn't have time to recover. After my release, the only way that I could justify my freedom was fighting for Shane and Josh.
So you went on a PR campaign.
Yeah, and I was like a machine. I didn't taste my food. I ate and exercised mechanically. I had a mission, and that somehow helped me avoid my symptoms. But when they were out, it was like all of the pain, all of the whole experience was locked deep in a box inside myself. And when I opened that box, it was terrifying.
You were, Josh and Shane, you were kept for another 10 months after Sarah was released. Did you have any hopes of finally being released yourselves?
Well, it's this psychology that I felt what happened with my mind was that I'd get letters and feel like, wow, so many people care about us. I can't believe this. And then another day passes and another day passes and that memory just starts to slip. You start to think, well, really? Is that really true? Are they still doing anything? Or have they forgotten? And so that's why getting letters constantly was so important. And really the dynamic of having Sarah there and having Sarah released really changed the dynamic with Shane and I. We found that, we could only rely on each other to sort of fill each other's needs, and that just wasn't happening. So,
well, did you find any comfort in realizing that you were political footballs rather than people who are actually being accused of a crime?
It gave us comfort because when the UN General Assembly was coming up in 2011, we thought, well, Sarah was released at the UN General Assembly in 2010. Maybe, they'll throw us, throw the football of us for this UN General Assembly. But it was all speculation and I had come to not trust too much speculation by that point.
I remember during that second year just thinking of, when Sarah got out, it was kind of a big relief in a lot of ways because Sarah had really been deteriorating at that time, and her getting out felt like it was kind of a weight off my shoulders, and I think Josh felt the same way. And then our world really became our cell, and I remember having conversations with Josh about, the self, and do we really have different egos at this point, because we literally never could separate from each other. And even after getting out of prison, there was a period of time where I, after 2 years of isolation, I couldn't read body language of people. I actually had to tell Sarah and my family to speak, to tell me exactly what they mean, because I couldn't read the subtleties, but I could read every subtlety of Josh's face.
We at first, when we were together, we would have these sort of philosophical discussions and be like arguing about, free will or something grand. And by the end, we were just arguing about space. This size mine, this size your. So it was like living in that kind of cell together.
Well, Sarah, in the epilogue, you describe experiencing conflicted feelings of happiness, rage, and depression in the months that followed your release. What were the stages of emotions you went through, and where would you say you are in terms of the process of healing now?
Well,
it's been a number of years.
Yeah. No, I mean, I feel great now. I think there's so many ways that we're fortunate, just as many ways that we were unfortunate. But, you know, in the scheme of things, the reason that we wrote the book is that we wanted to talk about the horror of losing your freedom, you know, the miracle of getting it back. But our book is also about all the people that don't get it back. And I had rage, I had depression for many years, insomnia. I was haunted by the things that happened to me. But today I feel stronger for the experience, and not everyone gets to that point.
I'm sure you're following the situation in Iran. Do you think that the same thing would have happened if the current president, Hassan Rouhani, had been in power?
I think it's hard to say. You know, it's easy from here to see Rouhani as kind of controlling the whole situation in Iran. There's still at least 800 political prisoners in Iran. The judiciary is controlled by people who are opposed to Rouhani. So, you know, a lot of this, the executions, the rise in executions, and a lot of people see this as kind of a way for the family that controls the judiciary to kind of give Rouhani kind of a bad image.
Well, before Ahmadinejad became the president, I've forgotten the name of the man who preceded him, but he was seen as a liberal, and he couldn't get anything done.
Mm-hmm.
And even Ahmadinejad, not too long after we were imprisoned, he wanted to release us, but was held up by a lot of the rest of the government.
Really, yeah. Between both countries, there's a faction within each country, and in Iran, the faction's quite large. That has a sort of ideology that won't let that country reach out to the other ones. And with this current negotiations over the nuclear deal, we're seeing those factions lose a little bit of headway to moderates within each country, and hopefully they can come up with something.
But there still is a debate in this country as to whether we can trust Iran at all.
Yeah. And we're, you know, things, people in Iran that I've talked to are guardedly hopeful, but it's still a temporary agreement, this historic nuclear breakthrough. And in a small way, our case played a role in that. The Omani government facilitated our release, paid the bail, $500,000 for each of us. And they've played a really constructive role between the U.S. and Iran. And they actually arranged the first face-to-face meetings between U.S. and Iranian officials that led to the nuclear deal.
So your freedom was really paid for?
Yeah.
Well,
you weren't just released because you didn't do anything?
No, it was actually right after Josh and I were sentenced to 8 years, and a couple of months after that, we were released.
8 years for what?
For illegal entry and espionage. We went through a trial where, you know, the judge said that we were the head of a grand American-Israeli conspiracy and wove all these tales, and and we got out 2 months later.
Our freedom was literally paid for by the Omani government, the Omani envoy. But where a total breakdown in diplomacy failed, 2 years of the U.S. and Iran, the government's not even willing to talk to each other, an international campaign succeeded. It was really the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people around the world that continued to fight for us, that eventually the tipping point came, and the Iranian government wanted to get us off their hands.
My great thanks to the three of you for being on our show, Sarah Shurd, Joshua Fatale, Shane Bauer. Their book, which is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, is called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.